Hey, good morning, church. So I appreciate Sean introducing me as the new youth minister, and Chris did as well. And while technically that is true, I am new again in youth ministry. My first day in youth ministry was December 30th, 2004, and I sat in the first Sunday. It was the second Sunday in this building, I believe. It had just kind of been built. It was brand new. It was shiny. It was fresh. And I was sitting where Ty Mathis is right now. And Robin and I, brand new, excited couple in youth ministry. We walk in. We get here early, and we're sitting. And we don't know where to sit. And we just kind of, you know, we knew the youth was in this area, always has been. And we sat there. And, you know, we met many people. People are excited. People are confused. You know, you're new here, whatever. And so an older lady came down, and she kind of tapped me on the shoulder. And I turned to say hello, and I stood up and introduced myself, thinking she's here to welcome the new youth minister or say how happy she is I was here. And she said, I said, hey, I'm Aubrey, I'm the new youth minister. She goes, okay, you're in my seat. And I laughed, thinking, what a good joke. Like, what a way to welcome somebody as a joke. And I was like, ha-ha. She's like, you're in my seat. And so we scooted over like about 8 inches. Like, I wanted to be like that close and just kind of get to know her a little bit. And that was good. So I appreciate the compliment of saying new youth minister. But at the same time, I get called old a lot by the kids. Most of my youth ministry compatriots, my league of youth ministers, guys and girls who are my age are no longer youth ministers. They're getting out. COVID took care of that for a lot as far as just transitioning careers. Church, it was such a hard time in churches. We all know this. That's the last time I'll mention that up here, by the way. But during that time, over 50% of men and women that were in youth ministry before COVID are no longer in youth ministry. Like, it was just a nuclear meltdown for difficult relational time for everybody, not just them. That's true on a lot of different careers, but it killed a lot of youth ministry careers. Just difficult season, and it was seemed never ending. And it was in a time where relational closeness and proximity was needed, that was the thing that was dangerous and forbidden and being away from each other. So that was a hard thing. So as I look at the different seasons of life that Robin and I have gone through, and now we've added 5 kids and 20 years later and re-upping in youth ministry. So as we think a little bit about crazy people trusting God, I do trust God, and I get accused of being crazy a lot. I also, that's outside of just my age. I call myself a youth minister granddad a lot. Jokingly, but also I've got a lot of former students who now have their own kids who are almost joining the youth group this next year. I'm super excited about it, but that's wild. Like, that's certifiable according to several buddies of mine who are in corporate America. And so when I think through what I do and how I do it, I don't want to make today about me at all. I'm going to talk about myself for a few minutes, but then we're going to pivot and talk much more about Jesus and how he approaches people and how effective he is. And that's all I'm trying to do and failing consistently. But I want to introduce you to this chair for a second. I know this is a strange thing. I enjoyed watching some faces. They're like, what is this old chair doing on stage? And I will tell you, this is one of my favorite possessions that I own. It is a chair that is, I'll describe it first, I guess. It's definitely old. It's almost 100 years old. It is not comfortable. Comfort was not the key with the designer who made this chair. Of all the chairs and couches and other things in my office, that's where this chair resides, is in my office most of the time. And as kids plop in, this is normally the last chair that gets sat in. And sometimes when they sit in it, they put a throw pillow on it to make it a little more comfortable. And it fits about like it looks. It's uncomfortable. It's pretty. It doesn't. It's strange. It's a weird style. Like, it's not. It was my grandmother's chair. She bought this chair when she got her first big girl job on the eve of World War II. Like, she was a single, almost 30-year-old woman during World War II. And my grandmother, Noreen Brock, one of the greatest women that ever lived, loved her so much. But as she got her first big girl job working in Montgomery, Alabama, as a single 6'1" woman working on the kind of in the war effort. She was a bookkeeper at a local business. And as she was doing things like that with one of her first paychecks, as she's paying rent, she's kind of living in an apartment and living her life as a young woman, she buys a chest of drawers, and she buys this chair and a couple other things. And this is when she passed, things sat in their garage for a long time until my grandfather passed. And when he was finally gone several years back, and the whole family made their way to spend some time together and kind of go through the belongings and go through that whole process of unpacking a lifetime together, this chair was one of only a few things that ended up with me. Not because I don't like the other things. Robin and I were in a stage of life with a lot of kids and a lot of things in our house already. So anything we would have taken furniture-wise, we would have had to get rid of something else to replace it. Many of you have been there. So my sister, who was in a different stage of life, was filling up a house with furniture, and she's getting these beautiful bureaus and other things. We didn't need those things. But I picked a weird yellow Tupperware pitcher that I remember sweet tea being poured out of, and I still use it almost every day. And I picked an old quilt that was my mom's, kind of a scrap quilt that my grandmother had made out of all her dresses as a little girl. And this chair are the only, and a ladder, and a ladder that I wouldn't stand on if you paid me because it will break. But it's my granddad's old wooden ladder, and I thought what a cool homage to have in the back of my garage with all the other things in it. So those are the only possessions I have from my grandparents' lifetime together. And that may seem weird or sad, but I love this chair. Mostly because it also describes me. You may not think I'm old. I hear from the students I work with a lot how old I am. I'm fine with it. I've embraced that. It's part of me. But as I think about this chair and it being strange, nobody has ever described, even with the beautiful wood inlay and it was carved and all the work that went into this chair, nobody in the history of 100 years has probably ever looked at this chair and said, you know what? That ties the whole room together. Because it has never matched anything it's been around. My grandmother's house included. It was hodgepodge. It was wild. My grandmother had a different couch that was like a love seat, and it had like lace over, not before she put the protective white, clear coating on it, which was wild. But as she had this one chair, she had one chair that had like a lace overlay sewed into it that had potpourri under it, like a potpourri-infused chair. Sat next to this one for years. I did not end up with that chair. That chair creeped me out, and it was crunchy sometimes from the old potpourri. It was not awesome. But this chair, I love it. And even with the history of it and knowing what it's been through, it sits in my office, and it kind of does match in my office because my office is hodgepodge, and it's stuff from everywhere. But to me, I love it. And I also love embracing who I am, which is kind of like this chair. I get described as old, certainly. But in addition to that, I don't know. I have a strange sense of style sometimes. Bill Sampson and I have been compared a lot in the last couple years as far as how comfortable we are wearing things. We've both been described as getting dressed in the dark in a thrift store, which I think is hilarious. But as you think about just pulling things off the rack and be like, I like the way this feels. That looks good. And it may not match each other. And I have a wife who helps me with that often. She's like, that didn't work. Not because of style or she's embarrassed, but because the colors together are offensive and would hurt. And so I think about that in my life, and it's not a big deal. It's not something I wrestle with. I enjoy my approach to life. As I've had students for the last 20 years, I asked one time two of my students who were serving as student aides in the ministry position I was in, Maddie Sanders and Emma Owens, and as I asked them both, they were seniors in high school at the time, now they're late in college, but I asked them one time, I said, hey, if a student walked into this school and had never heard of a campus minister, didn't know who I was, how would you describe my vibe to them? And be unfiltered. Be savage if you need to. That's the word they would have used. And they instantly said, like way too quick, like they'd already had the conversation somehow beforehand, but instantly Maddie said, I don't know, like a Disney dad and a tourist and a youth minister. I don't know, kind of Willy Wonka. I don't know. It's like a combination of those things. And I think that's the most accurate description I've ever had of me. In my approach to life of embracing the strange and silly, not growing up, but also having some mature ports and stops along the way. So it's a back and forth that teenagers, people in general, don't really know what to do with. I watch people all day. That's a weird thing to say, but sometimes we went to Dollywood this weekend. Me and the teenagers and a few adults went to Dollywood. That's some top tier people watching. But as I think about my life and watching people, I don't watch people so I can laugh at them. Hopefully I want to laugh with them. But all day long, my entry point into people's lives are normally strange. They're normally just weird, one-off moments where I'm looking for a moment to just splash the water, kind of see what happens. And sometimes hilarity ensues and there's a connection. Sometimes people leave very awkwardly without words. So I want to give three of those real quickly just to paint a picture. And then we're going to jump into the life and stories of Jesus. Several years ago, I went to China. I've told you this before, but specifically this story, I walked through a cafeteria, like a big food court in Hangzhou, China, and I noticed one student. I'd seen students all week long, people all across the country, and nobody was near my height. I don't say that as a brag. It was, if anything, it was awkward because 100 times a day I would see somebody doing this when I walked by, and I would turn and go, hey, and scatter real quick, like, oh, I'm so sorry, or can we take your picture? You're the tallest man we've ever seen, which is not true. They'd seen taller people, but when the majority are around 5 foot, and then I'm just this giraffe walking through, it brought attention. So we walked through a cafeteria. There's probably 500 Chinese students in here. The population in Hangzhou, China is 11 million, and it's over 99% Chinese only. So the 11 students I brought with me, two of which that were blonde, all week long with cameras on them. But we walked through this food court, 500 students-ish in this area, and I see one guy, and I see his knees like higher than the table, like it's me. Basically, I see a guy who's probably my height, and I haven't seen that all week. And so I just left my group and walked over to this table, and he's got four or five friends sitting with him, and I stopped next to him, and I just put my hand way up in the air. And I waited 4 or 5 awkward seconds before I did this. Like, showed him. I want a high five. And I put it up because I wanted him to stand up and show this cafeteria there's somebody else my height. And he just smiled at me. Didn't move. Didn't say no. Didn't say yes. Just went. And one of his friends, I didn't notice him kind of moving. After about 5 long seconds, and I just left it up there. I was like, this is where I live now. I'm just going to leave my hand in the air until this guy makes a decision. He can say no, then I'll walk away. But until then, we're just going to stand off. And this other guy, who was probably 4'10", jumps up on the table and goes, and slaps my hand. And the whole cafeteria, I didn't realize we were being watched so intently. And the whole cafeteria goes, yeah, and like yells. And I go, and I stop for a second. And it was a shocking, weird moment. And I walk away. And that's just, it's silliness. But I did not expect that to happen. Another weird moment. I'm in Haiti a year after this. I'm in Haiti, and I'm driving through with a buddy of mine who's showing us kind of the area. We've got some kids in the back of this open-air truck bed, and we passed by this area where we had to stop and drop off some stuff. And we had just, right next door, we passed this orphanage-type school, and we didn't know them. We didn't have a connection, and the kids are playing out in the yard. And it's the first basketball goal I've ever seen in Haiti. Like, normally, it's all soccer. It's all football. So as they're playing soccer, normally, I see these couple of kids dribbling a basketball to each other. They're passing, but they're dribbling in a country where they don't dribble or pass or shoot. They don't play basketball. They don't know the rules normally. And so they're just awkwardly passing to each other. And I know we're stopping about 100 yards up here. So they stop in front of it. A couple of the missionaries run inside. And as they run inside to drop things, the kids are in the truck. And I said, be right back. And I leave the truck. And I walk onto the basketball court, not knowing anybody there. And I just said, passe, passe. And like, they look at me. And weirded out, one kid kind of underhand passes it to me, and I take one step, and I jump up, and I dunk on their goal, and I just walk away. And as I walk away, one kid says, Blanco! Like, what? He screams the word white, and they all start clapping, and then I just leave, and our kids are like, what do you do? You're so weird. Like, get back on the bus. And the kid's like, you're so strange. And it's true, but it's also silly moments, and that's not remotely theological or deep or connection, but sometimes connection moments happen. Sometimes silliness happens, and it bonds a group. This weekend is a great example of that. We laughed our heads off the entire weekend. We went to Gatlinburg. We stayed in a cabin that was a connection Miss Charlotte White had, and we just ate, and we had time around the table. The kids helped cook and clean and pass stuff out. We had a ping pong tournament that kids are cheering and screaming like it was bigger than the World Cup. We just spent family time together, and it was awesome. It was so special. I'm going to tell you one more story that doesn't paint me in a great light, and then we're going to jump right into Jesus, because sometimes I have these moments, and it ends up with 500 people clapping. Sometimes I have moments where they scream a name. They don't even know my name, so they call me Blanco, and people clap, and I walk away. And those are fun. Those are moments that I will treasure until I go home one day. Another moment doesn't bring me much proud. As I was in Walmart, Brainerd Walmart, I go there a lot. I'm there as often as I'm there more than any of you. Unless you happen to work there, then I might rival you anyway. A couple of the guys who work at the front door know me so well now that we know each other by name. And as we kind of say something, I walked in there a couple days ago, right before the trip. As I walk in, one of them said, you clocking in? Because he's joking with me because he sees me 5 days a week. So as I'm walking through interacting with people, most of my interactions are healthy and good and fun. It's also one of my favorite places to practice Spanish. I've never had a bad interaction with a local Spanish speaker just saying, hey, I'm trying to practice Spanish, and say a few things, and they say a few things, and it always goes well. I'm always well received when I'm trying to practice Spanish with somebody at Aldi or Walmart. It just goes well. But I go down the main aisle, and I tend to treat Walmart like the highway system. This is a side lesson. As I'm walking through the main thoroughfare, that's the highway, and the aisles are the side streets. So if I'm coming off a side street, I don't blast into the main aisle without looking, or if I do, it's my fault. So I back up and say, sorry, excuse me, something of that like. So I'm going through the main aisle. I have the right-of-way in my mind, and this woman comes barreling out of a side aisle, which I still stopped. I don't want to hit her, so I stopped. And she stopped in front of me, intentionally bumped her cart into mine, and looked at me in the face and said, move, like aggressive, said move. And something snapped in my brain. I didn't yell. I didn't lose it. Don't worry. But what I did do was strange. As soon as she said move and she bumped my cart, I had a weird moment. And my eyes went really wide and I just went. And as long as I'm looking at you, I held it that long. That 3 seconds felt like an eternity. And after about 2 seconds of hissing, and 3 seconds of silent looking, I never blinked. Like, my eyes were dry, and I was, and just looked. She finally went back down the aisle, and one of the employees that I see all the time, I didn't know her name, she just looked at me and went, well, that's a way to handle it. And she went down the aisle laughing hysterically. So there was some funniness in it, a little bit of regret,
But it was one of those moments. I guarantee she thought about it afterward. Regardless of what she thinks about me, she'll probably think about it again before she barrels out. Or every time she does, she may think about the cat noise I made. So I don't have pride in that. I honestly feared telling you that a little bit for the just fear of judgment. But it's me. As a youth minister, my goal is to laugh, connect, and build relationship. So that when one of life's storms hits one of our students, which will happen, we all in adulthood know that. There's going to be a storm, there's going to be a loss, there's going to be a failure, there's going to be addiction or struggle or pain or you name it. I don't want to paint a sad picture. We know that this world's filled with those things. So I want to create relationships in a healthy way focused on Jesus so that when one of life's storms happens, I'm on their speed dial. I may not be the one they call, but I'm on a list of people they can trust so that when they reach out, I can say the hard thing. I can drop truth. I can also love them through that storm. I'm not the only one that does that. You do that for your own kids, and may probably for other. There are other kids who may consider you, adults, their second set of parents. You may have gotten that, or they may call you aunt or uncle, and that term of familiarity is a sign of trust. If they call you on a hard day, or they show up and say, oh, it's just not going great, those are one of those moments where they are trusting you with a hard storm, and it's a big deal. So that's my entire game plan. There's no secrets. That's my entire playbook of how to approach teenagers is just try to make sure they know that I'm okay to laugh at myself. Because when we navigate life, sometimes you have successes, sometimes you have failures, but moving forward and choosing to do better is all we can do. Because I'm not, my worst moments don't define me, thankfully. My best moments don't either, because neither one of those are a true reflection of my greatness or my terribleness, for lack of a better term. I'm not either of those extremes. We are all the sum total of working toward being closer to Jesus and letting him be the one that shines through. When Paul talks about being crazy, please receive me like a fool because you know that I've worked harder than anybody else. I'm not saying that about me. Paul says, I've worked harder. I've done so many things for the gospel, but also I am a fool. So receive me as one so that anytime you see me do something great, you don't have to ask me, Aubrey, why are you so good at that? You don't have to ask because you already know I'm not. There are plenty of times you could just bring up the list of failures I have or the list of successes, and neither one of those are me by myself. It's focusing on Jesus, trying to walk with him, because I always want his face to be the one reflected, unless I'm just not living up and avoiding. That's what I'm trying to be away from. Aubrey without Jesus is a failure 100% of the time. Because if I focus on me or my strengths or my gifts and don't take Jesus with me, it doesn't go well. Because at my best, you've got some talents, got some wins, and in our worst moments, we don't want to be defined by those. When I think about Jesus' playbook, with the disciples, I would argue from the world's perspective that Jesus is the worst drafter in the history of drafts when he picked his team. He picked a group of illiterate idiots. And that's a term that in the early texts, a lot of times they were referred to as because they were uneducated. They were untested. They weren't talented on paper. A lot of them hadn't been chosen to be the teachers and the law and the any of these other high up authorities. Instead, they had lowly jobs. They were tradesmen. One of them is the closest thing I'd compare Luke to is a nurse, which is amazing, and he did great things. But the training that would have gone into that is not like our RNs and above now, where it's years and years and years. To me, it's equitable to somebody who could go in and help you with certain things, or a field medic, or a midwife was what it's closer to, which are jobs I couldn't get near. But none of them were wildly educated, higher educated individuals at all. And Jesus drafted them, and he graduated 11 of the 12. And as he had time with them, he did life with them. He built up relationship and trust. He walked into situations with them. He confused them all the time. And a lot of the times, what I remind teenagers in teaching is that when Jesus did a miracle, I love reading the context of that miracle to find out who he was doing it for. Because it wasn't always for the person he healed. Certainly, it gave them a blessing. And it changed their perspective on life forever. But a lot of times he was doing it for the disciples. He was training them like a father trains his children to trust and to listen and to think before you act, think before you speak. Maybe just watch for a little while. I can't imagine the frustration that Jesus had on certain days thinking, good grief. Like, Father, like, I know this is the team we picked. Frustrating. Like, they're missing it. And he'd show them. And it said, a lot of times in Scripture it'll say, and then later on they remembered. And then later on they understood. And later on it became understood in their brain. But I want to go through a story for just a few minutes in John chapter 9.
If you want to look along in your Bibles, you can. A lot of this story, I'm not even just going to read to you. I'm going to talk to you. I'm going to paraphrase. I'm going to narrative story form, just talk to you. And then later on, certainly read through it and look at this. But in John chapter 9, we have a story of the man born blind. His name is not even recorded in Scripture. I don't think that's accidental. I think it's more of an issue of that's who he was in town. The guy was 39 years old, and his entire life up until this point, he'd been blind. That's all he's known as. He's the blind guy. Like, I'm sure their town had several people who sat out on the front steps. So he spent most of his life from the time, instead of going to his father's trade or being sent away to another tradesman to learn their fishing or net making or tent making or carpentry or any of those things, instead he was sent to the temple stairs. And he would sit outside the temple stairs, and he would hear the jingle of coins all day. As a reminder to those who were coming into the temple, they were expected, it was their duty to drop some coins on some people who couldn't make money otherwise. The people who were dropping the coins didn't respect or want relationship with the person dropping the coins, the person shaking the coins. They weren't looking to connect with them or to bring them in or to be friends with them. If anything, they kind of judged them. I think you understand the imagery. Maybe how many times you roll up a window at a stoplight because of who's next to the window. And there's no judgment in me saying that. There are some times where I have felt massively uncomfortable with who is standing way too close to my car next to my little girl. And so I rolled up the window, they probably heard the lock of my door as we locked the doors real quick just to make sure nobody opened it. It's a little confession, I guess. But day after day, 39 years old, jingling of coins. And he would sit outside the temple, and Jesus and the disciples approach. And I know you've had a moment where you felt talked about, not talked to, but somebody is in front of you talking about you. Or maybe you have that maybe your ears are burning. Somebody, you just can tell, like when you walk in a room, the conversation just the air gets sucked out of the room. So the conversation was probably about you. It may not have been. I'm not trying to put that seed of doubt in your head. I'm saying I felt that, or maybe as it unfolded, you realized you were talked about. And that is a feeling of betrayal, a feeling of, I don't know how to describe it, except it's not a good feeling. It's a day ruiner for me. And so as he is sitting here doing the only job he is capable of doing in this moment, especially in this culture and society, where if you were born with something wrong with you, any kind of deformity or something wrong with your body, your vision, your hearing, whatever, the assumption was, the teaching of the day was, you must have done something wrong or your parents did something wrong to deserve to be born with this malady. Well, we know now that's not the case. It's just genetics, and there's a lot of things that go into it. Who knows the degenerative condition he had to be born blind? But as he's born blind, he is seeing darkness only for his whole life. And Jesus and the disciples walk up, and a couple of the disciples say, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? He's sitting right here. So it's almost like they stopped and were like, hey, Jesus, this dude right here, like this guy. Like, they were probably having a conversation about him beforehand, and one of them drew the short straw and then asked Jesus, as they do, Jesus, what's the deal with this guy? Was he or his parents the sinners that he was born this way? And Jesus says, neither this man nor his parents sinned, but this happened that the work of God may be displayed in his life. And he goes on to some other confusing theological depths, and it rocks the disciples. They don't know what to do with that. But then Jesus does something extra weird. He had already planned to heal this guy. Jesus knows all things, understands our hearts, and he chooses to do this to change this guy's life, but also so that the will of God can be understood a little better. And so he doesn't even ask the guy like he does sometimes, do you want to be healed? Or do you trust? Or what is it you're looking for? He just goes up to him, and Jesus does something that I believe is offensive. He spits into his hand like it's some dirt, and he makes a little mud pie with spit, and he just wipes it on the guy's eyes. You think about the vulnerability of this guy sitting here day after day after day, jingling his coins. There have been times in his past where some kid went up and slapped him or threw something at him. He's been hit by things. I'm assuming this because of the nature of trolls and the nature of people who, if there's something wrong with him and he's sitting out, I know the way that people who are struggling with homelessness or addiction, or they may find themselves in hard times, I've had those conversations with them. Under a bridge in Huntsville, there's a homeless community, and some of the things that get said or done, or even just the repulsive nature of people's reaction to what they see in that person, breaks their heart, and it's sad, and it's hard. Whether it's deserved in their mind or not, they feel like outcasted. So this guy is not a part of the community. He sits on the outside, literally sits every day, and relies on the generosity of others that is compelled by religious teaching. So it's not because they want him to succeed or thrive or become rich. They're expected to give him money, and that's part of their calling, is to pay that. That's still a teaching in Jewish culture, is to give alms to the poor and to make sure they're taken care of. Whether you like it or not, it's part of what you're expected to do. And so as this guy hears this, and Jesus goes over and just wipes it on his face, I want to take one more sidestep and tell you, this is one of the most offensive, culturally, like, the ways to just not only ruin this guy's day, because he feels like he might be getting picked on, but as you wipe dirt on somebody, dirt is what goes on the bottom of your shoes. In this culture, in this time, like, that's the reason they go in and wash their hands and their feet when they'd go into a residence, because you're gross. You're carrying the world with you in, like, the grossness of the dirt and your sandals and all those things. Dirt is considered the lowest of low, under your feet, whereas the head is supposed to be holy and away from the ground and the highest thing toward God. There's a reason that, I'm not sure if they gave noogies back then or not, but that would not be a thing in young Jewish culture. Many different world religions, the top of the head being considered close to God, you wouldn't just go and rough up their head or mess with them, because that's closest to God. You definitely wouldn't take the bottom of the dirt from the bottom of your foot and touch that to anything that's clean. In the Iraq War back in the 90s, there's a reason that when the tanks pulled down Saddam Hussein statues, and there's these 90-foot-tall statues laying on the ground, and the Iraqis swarmed these statues. You can look up videos of this on YouTube. They took off their sandals, and they're just slapping the face of the statue with the bottom of their sandals, and dust is going everywhere, and they're screaming, and they're crying, because they've been freed from this tyranny. And the best way they could spite this tyrannical leader who's now gone was to wipe the dirt from the bottom of their shoes on his face. That was a middle finger, for lack of a better term, to everything he was about. It was disrespectful. It was, we hate you. It was spit. The other thing they would do, even now you can see things with the war going on over now in the Middle East, is people from other cultures that were expected to be hated, which is a horrible term, but as people would cross your path and they're considered your enemy or they're considered godless, a tax collector or a prostitute or somebody else would walk by and a Jewish conversation would be going on. They pause their conversation to spit on the ground, not on them, because that will get you in a fight, but to spit near them on the ground to show them, I want you to walk across my spit. I think so little of you that I won't talk to you, I won't look at you, but I'll spit near you. And it's just the ultimate sign of disrespect. So Jesus combines those two things, mixes it up on his hand, which is gross for him. The disciples would have judged Jesus for having that on his hands. But then he wipes it in the guy's eyes, and he says, hey, I want you to go to the pool of Siloam and wash off. And so the guy gets up and walks. It would have been much, much easier for him to take his sleeve and wipe it into his eyes, like, oh, picking on me again? Can I just exist? Can you please not pick on me? But he doesn't do that. He gets up and he goes. It's a mile and a half, and he walks. And I don't know if he knew the way by heart, or if he had memorized it, or if people led him, or what that situation was, but he goes to the pool, and he climbs in, and he washes off his face, and his world changed. He sees light for the first time. He sees colors for the first time. He sees people. Like, imagine this world that he's only heard and felt, and all the other senses that are probably heightened, probably had great ears. But then light becomes clear, and I imagine it was overwhelming. Like, some of my favorite videos to watch, and one of the only times that my allergies flare up while I'm watching YouTube, is when I see somebody who gets a cochlear implant for the first time, and they hear one of their loved one's voice for the first time. Whoa, can't even watch that. I got to pause it and take a minute, or watch something dumb so I can just laugh. But to watch somebody hear this voice that they have pictured and they felt the vibrations of in their life, but they've never heard it, and it just changes everything. Well, for me, the last of my five senses I would give up is my sight, because I'd be so dependent on others. I'm not good at relying on others. And as I think about seeing the world and how much I love it, earlier this summer, I got to go to Scotland with a group of kids. And going up to the Highlands, we get the sunniest day I've ever seen in my entire life. There's a mountain and the grass. Like, we just said, all right, kids, go play in the Highlands for a few minutes. And even watching Wyatt and Ty just go over to this, they're like, we're just going to lay down on this grass and just look at it. Like, green was redefined for me that week. Like, I know that's not a weird thing to say, but it was the greenest green that I've ever seen that probably has ever existed. And I remember sitting there and talking to my buddy Hope Watkins and said, is this weird to say I've never seen green like this? He goes, dude, I haven't blinked in like 2 minutes. I'm just soaking it in. It's like, good, I'm not that crazy, or we're both crazy. But to think about just redefining a color, and I'm artsy and I love all the colors. I need them all. This guy has never seen anything. Grayscale would have been amazing to him. If he saw the world through my dog's eyes, he would have been like, this is perfection. But instead, it's colors, and it's everything. I imagine that his walk to the pool, I don't know what it was like exactly. I doubt he was skipping or singing yet. When he washed it and he starts to see, I don't know this to be true, but my guess is he was making some noise. I can't imagine. I freak out sometimes when I see my team score or when I see a big moment with, you know, one of my kids or something. I'm just screaming and hollering and hooping. This is being given a gift at almost four decades of blindness, four decades of having the same light you have in a cave when you turn out the flashlights, and it's scary when you can't see your hand in front of your face. That's how he lived his life every single day. So I have to assume that he was skipping or that he was jumping or that he was screaming. I can see all this. Have you seen this bird? Have you seen this bird? Did you see that? He's like, that's a bird, man. Just a bird. It's like, yeah, but I've never seen one before. That's amazing. And just keep going. And like the lack of everybody else freaking out would have been difficult for me because I'm just so excited and you just want to match that excitement with everybody else. So he goes back to town. That mile and a half was a great walk, skip, jump, cartwheels. I don't know what he was doing, but he was so excited. And he gets back to town and he gets faced with a weird downer of people saying, is that the guy? Like, he looks a lot like that guy I keep giving money to. Bro, you faking it the whole time? Like, were you faking it? You owe me, like, a lot of money if you're faking it. Because you see that. You can find that, too, online when you say you've seen people that you wonder, are you really in need of my money, or are you just faking it to take advantage? Is that the easy route for you? And that's a hard thing that we wrestle with. So this guy goes from being a guy who struggled his whole life to make connections. He can't provide. He can't have a family because he can't provide. He's living with his parents at almost 40 years old and hasn't gotten to have a wife and kids, hasn't got to do those things that everybody would have wanted to do. And he comes back into town and people start debating whether he's really the guy or not. They don't talk to him. Again, he's being talked about. And they say, is that really him? Or is he just look like the guy? And he goes, it's me. I'm the guy. And they're like, are you really? And he feels like he's on trial with people. So I don't know what he goes back to, if he's just going to see his parents. It just says he goes back to town. And then he gets summoned by the Pharisees. So this guy, the same day that Jesus heals him, he gets put on trial. And they bring him into a room that I have to assume would be a very formal courtroom kind of setting. And you've got these high rulers in front of and behind their table, sitting in their chairs, higher up than him. And he's sitting in a chair, assumed, unless they made him stand before them. And they debate with him over and over whether he's really the guy, how he got healed. And they are grilling him like detectives to find out where the truth was. What really is going on is he gets caught up in a plot where they're already trying to find a way to kill Jesus, and they're just using him to find ammo to take him out. And so the guy realizes not that they're going after Jesus, but just he's being unfairly grilled about something he had no say in. He didn't ask to be healed. It's amazing, but he didn't beg for it. Jesus wiped it offensively on his face, sent him on a walk, and that faith-filled journey led him into the water, which washed his mud out in the light of life, the light of this, like the light that we see around us and take for granted every single day. He gets blessed with, skips back to town. They bring him in to put him on trial and they grill him. How did he heal you? How did he do this? Because it was on the Sabbath. They were just looking for a loophole to get Jesus. So finally they dismiss him and they call in his parents. So they bring in his elderly parents and put them in front of the court and say, was your son really born blind? Yeah, we can confirm he was born blind. He's been blind his whole life. Well, then how can he see now? He's 39 years old. You can ask him yourself. They threw him to the side because they knew that if we start giving credit to Jesus, anybody till this point that had given credit to Jesus or believed in him or become a follower is banished from the synagogue, which for them, if you can't go in and worship and do the things they're expected to do, means you don't get to be with God. So they start freaking out and they choose the safety of being allowed in the temple over standing by their son. And they say, he's of age. You should ask him yourself. And they say, we did ask him. And so they dismiss the parents and they re-summon the man born blind. They bring him back in for a second trial, same day. Like he's having a wild day. And they bring him back in and they say to him, how did you get your sight? And he goes, I've already told you. The man named Jesus wiped mud in my eyes. I went away and I washed and now I can see. And they keep asking him. They keep pushing him. And finally, he has enough, and he has a bold moment. And he goes, why do you keep asking me? Like, are you obsessed with him too? Are you trying to be his follower? Are you also wanting to be his follower? And they can't get him to back down. They can't get him to incriminate Jesus. So they do what most people in authority do when they can't get the answer out of you they want. They say, you know what? You have been steeped in sin since birth. You were born blind because you were a sinner, so you were out of the synagogue forever. And they kick him out. So he goes from being out of the synagogue for being blind, being given his sight, skipping home, being accused of being a faker, getting put on trial, getting kicked out and banished from the temple. He's had a crazy day. And he goes outside, and Jesus hears that he got kicked out, goes and finds him. So Jesus, having known who the guy is, this guy doesn't know who Jesus is at all. Jesus is just the guy who happened to wipe mud in his eyes and send him away. So he doesn't necessarily know his voice yet. They're not friends. And Jesus comes up to him, and they have a cool interaction. I'm going to read this part to you. Jesus heard they had thrown him out, and when he found him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" "Who is he, sir?" the man asked. "Tell me so that I may believe in him." Jesus said, "You've now seen him." I love that he said, "You've now seen him." He didn't just say, "You're standing with him." He says, "Hey, by the way, you've now seen him." Like, you've seen very few things in your life, but you've seen this. He says, "You've now seen him. In fact, he's the one speaking with you." That's a weird way to say it's me. That's just a fancy way of saying it's me. And Jesus says, and then the man said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshiped him. And Jesus said, "For judgment I've come into this world, so that the blind will see, and those who will see will become blind." Some Pharisees who were with him heard this, and they asked, "What, are we blind too?" And Jesus says, "If you were blind, you wouldn't be guilty of sin. But you claim you can see, so your guilt remains." Like, this chapter, to me, has so many highs and lows. And as Jesus does this, certainly so that the will of his Father can be made known a little bit more, and that the glory of God can be unveiled through a miracle, and this guy can be given sight, which is beautiful. He was given a life. I don't know that he went on to what kind of trade or wife and kids or anything else, but I'll tell you what, he soaked in some views. And the guy, for whatever days he had, he appreciated sight like nobody in this room has ever appreciated sight, unless you have a story I don't know about, which I would love to hear. But this guy goes from 4 decades of darkness to bright colors and life and richness. And he appreciated, he had to have appreciated that. But for him to get kicked out of the temple, but then to meet Jesus and be, to have a moment of worship and connection, whatever the rest of his life was like, that is a moment that I personally love that we don't have his name. Not because he wasn't important or any less important than any one of us, but because this entire chapter is about being blind and being given the opportunity to see spiritually and physically. Like, Jesus bookended the chapter with physical sight and then spiritual sight. As I think about my decisions every single day, way too often I make decisions and I act on those decisions as if I'm still with whatever malady I had before, my BC days, my before Jesus days. And I think about the selfishness of when I want what I want and I'm not focusing on Jesus, I make the wrong decision. When I want what I want and I get insecure, I don't act in the same way I do when I'm reliant on Jesus in those moments of bold goofiness and just jumping off the high dive and thinking about just splashing in with people and making a difference. And when we bomb, and that's okay. There are so many stories that I could tell you, I won't right now, that I could tell you about times that teenagers have watched me attempt to engage with somebody and it just fell flat. Like, their reaction was so lackluster and silly and weird that I was like, "Well, that was awkward and sorry, everybody." And just kind of, we just move on. And they weren't inappropriate. It was just awkward and it was weird and they weren't feeling the vibe that we were all putting out. But the cool thing is, it doesn't matter. We're just trying to be a light. We're trying to bring joyful moments. We're trying to engage with people. And when we rely on Jesus for those, for me personally, bombing or failing, if somebody doesn't instantly get on board with what I'm doing, that's not a failure. Planting seeds for Jesus is the win. That's what we're called to do. Your way of doing that is probably very different than mine, and I'm thankful for that. Paul goes through a whole list of spiritual gifts and how each one of us is wired in a different way. And when we bring those together, it's orchestra music, and it's perfect, and it's on pitch, and it's just beautiful to hear. When any single person starts doing their own thing within that, you can just hear it. You can tell. One person I like to watch when music is going really, really good or really, really bad is Lori Wortman. I didn't tell her I was going to say this, but I love watching Lori when it's great or when it's awful, because for all of her talent in acting, she can't act in those moments. Because she has that look when, like, there's one voice off, she'll go, Like, I've watched that through her door so many times where one's a little off and they pause and they kind of figure it out. And she doesn't blast them, but she just says, "Oh, we got to do it. We're going to adjust this." That's the nicest way of saying, we're off. We got to fix it. But when it's good and it's great and it's just beautiful and we're all using our own talents and gifts, that's a beautiful sound. It's a beautiful thing to witness. And when I look at times in my life when I'm walking selfishly, I'm not part of a team. I'm usually by myself in those moments. It's when I'm walking with a collective and we're working together that there's harmony and that we're pulling in a common direction. So I want to leave you with this. We each have a choice of who we're going to be. And it's difficult some days. Because when I look up when I look up in the mirror and the first thing I think is, what do you want to do today? Man, I'm already kind of missing it probably. But I think we have three choices of who we're going to be. You can be who you've always been. You can just keep your current trajectory and keep walking through life. And maybe that's great. I'm not sure what your trajectory is right now. But without intentionality or without a different decision, it will probably remain the same trajectory because we're creatures of habit and we keep doing the things that we do. Especially when I focus on my selfishness, you just keep going in that direction. You can be who other people tell you you are. If you're looking to be defined by other people, they will gladly give you an answer. They will probably give you advice on who you should be. But if your only metric for success or failure is measuring up to what other people are calling you to be, telling you who you are, and that's not based in Jesus, then it's going to be a miserable ride of trying to figure out who you are. And you'll continue to change and change the mask, change the face, change the direction until you just feel lost. Number three, and the one that I found to be a lot more, it can be uncomfortable, but it's a lot more consistent, is to be becoming exactly who Jesus intends me to be. That's not correct English, by the way. But to be becoming, to constantly be in transition, refining our hearts, asking God to make us a better version of who we are in Him, that's the only way I've found joy. Because when I'm comparing my gifts to other people, I will always be lackluster. When I compare what I bring to the table or what I want to be or what I want to do, I am insanely jealous of my little brother when it comes to musical talent. He can just pick up an instrument and figure it out, and I hate that he can do that sometimes. It's really, really good, and I'm glad he can, and it's a blessing. But in my moments of jealousy, it's frustrating because he can literally just, he sat down on a piano and by ear just kind of figured out the Titanic song one day, and I was like, that's dumb that you can do that. It's amazing, but it's frustrating as somebody who is jealous of it. I'm glad that he brings that gift to the world and he's able to bless people in that way. If I only focus on that and work super hard and paid for guitar lessons three different seasons of my life, and all three times I ended with me saying, I'm not going to be great at this. Why do I keep doing this? Because I'm trying to be somebody that I wasn't. But instead, when I go after the things that I'm good at or great at and put that into a collective with other people who are talented at what they're talented at, there's harmony, and it's a gift, and that's amazing. So I'm here to challenge you to use your gifts for the kingdom, even when you bomb, even when you fail. Doing ministry to me is coming up with a plan, praying about it, trying it, and when it's successful, keep pouring in and giving God the glory. And when it bombs, reskin it, rethink it, go back to the drawing board and do something else. And keep trying, because I've got multiple layers of times where I've failed and it's not worked. But the times where God is in the forefront and we're seeking Him is always a win, even when it's not a win, if that makes sense. When you use your gifts for the kingdom, when you seek after God, you tie a room together. Even if your gifts look strange like mine and they happen to be packaged as a weird wood inlaid, like carved, uncomfortable chair, because some of my greatest gifts when I'm focusing on God are being willing to say the hard thing, because I build kids up and I want to bless them and I want to make them feel good about life. And not that it's always great, but I want them to have a safe place and a relationship with Jesus so that on those hard days we can redirect and we can say the hard thing. Jesus did that all the time, of building them up and then saying hard things sometimes. So as we spend this time together and we're about to sing a song, it is so difficult sometimes. I remember growing up, just this is totally unfiltered, 1 second and then we'll be done. I remember growing up, always in church, having these weird thoughts when people would go forward in church, like, oh man, I wonder what's going on. Because that's a weird backwards way of thinking about all of us needing God and needing prayer and needing to consistently being renewed and refined. So God's invitation is open all the time. That's not just in this moment. Certainly there's room in the back where the elders are, and you can talk with them if it's coming forward. Or if you're more like me, sometimes I just need to check myself and pray and re-up with God that I just want to be yours, and I just want to follow you, and I want to stop being so distracted by all the dumb stuff around me that does distract me and pull me down, and I want to be yours. If y'all will, let's pray, and then we'll sing. Father God, thank you for today. Thank you for time together. God, right now, I just thank you for different examples of times where I have bombed and things haven't gone well because I realized in hindsight I wasn't focusing on you. And other times where successes were found and I felt really good about myself only to realize that you were behind it the entire time and that's the reason for any success we have. God, I pray right now that if there's anything on our hearts that we need to lay before you, that we can do that in whatever way is appropriate. In your son's name we pray. Amen.